Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from relators in Huey v. DeShazzo.
May it please the court, Judge Alexander will present argument for relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This mandamus proceeding presents a legal issue of first impression in the state of Texas. That is whether a fiduciary may claim the attorney-client privilege to the exclusion of one or more beneficiaries. The answer to that question in Texas has to be yes for three fundamental reasons. First, because the attorney-client privilege rule which controls the resolution of this issue, that is Rule 503 of the Texas Rules of Civil Evidence, compels this result under legal principles already recognized in Texas. Under Rule 503A, the threshold question is, who is the client? Texas has already answered that question in another context directly applicable here. It is the fiduciary and the fiduciary alone who is the client. And because of that, under the unambiguous language of 503, the fiduciary enjoys all of the benefits of the attorney-client privilege set forth in that rule because none of the exceptions are applicable. Second, the analysis that compels this result in Texas is supported by decisions from other jurisdictions which have been cited by both parties in this case. Those cases, like Texas, view the attorney-client privilege rule as being the controlling rule for resolution of the issue. They view the central question the same, that is, who is the client? Now, having said that, a number of these jurisdictions have reached a result contrary to what we are urging here. That is, they have concluded that the fiduciary may not claim the privilege.
Mr. Alexander, very quickly, you say that the law in Texas is very clear, the fiduciary and only the fiduciary is the client.
Correct.
Seems to me, you cited one authority that dealt with the lawyer for the testator setting up the estate. Is there another one that talks about the
personal representative?
Personal representative.
Yeah. Thompson versus Vincent Elkins is that case, and that is in fact a personal representative case.
You keep saying the law is absolutely settled in this area. I've not been in the custom of thinking that one opinion from a court of appeals settles an issue.
Yeah, and I understand the concern. I've handed out a handout that addresses that concern, I believe. Under tab 2, I've included citations from, and let me start out by saying, one thing that's interesting about this is that this particular assertion that we have made, that this is well settled in Texas, has never been challenged. If you look at their briefs, there is no challenge to our argument that this is a settled principle of Texas law. But because I understand, particularly since this is not a Supreme Court decision, Thompson versus Vincent, there may be some discomfort with respect to that conclusion. What I set out under tab 2 is decisions, other modern decisions from around the country that have raised precisely the same conclusion. Now, once again, those decisions are all in the context of attorney malpractice. The argument has been made that they're an apposite. I say they are not. But this conclusion that the fiduciary is the client is by no means a novel conclusion. And in fact, the reasoned decisions on that point dictate that result. Finishing up on the second point that I was making, the decisions that have reached a different result, that have reached the conclusion that the fiduciary may not claim the privilege, have done so because they have answered this threshold question different than we would answer in Texas. That is, they have concluded that the beneficiaries alone is the client, or they have concluded that there's a joint client situation giving rise to the joint client exception, the same type of exception that we have under 503D. or they have concluded that the client is a legal entity, the ERISA cases. But the analysis in those cases absolutely supports the position that we are urging in this case, that because in Texas the fiduciary is and should be recognized for proper reason as being the client, then the result should be that the fiduciary may maintain the attorney-client privilege for all the reasons set forth in West v. Toledo with Republic Insurance Code of Davis.
Exactly. What about the line of cases that say, even so, that under the nature of the lawsuit, the only evidence to show the alleged wrongdoing is exactly what the privilege is covering, and that a good cause is therefore shown by a party attempting to get that information, and that should overcome the privilege? What's your response to that?
The response to that would be this. First off, the cases, and there's not a lot, that have in other jurisdictions, that have recognized the good cause.
Well, for case of first impression, I guess we're going to have to look somewhere
else. Yes, and I think you should. I mean, and I'm not suggesting that you don't. I mean, I think that, I will say this, having said that, that one of the problems you're going to find is that when you look at these cases in other jurisdictions, many of them are wanting in a lot of analysis. I mean, this is a hard case from that standpoint, because there's not much reporting.
Well,
but getting back to your question.
What's wrong with that theory then?
The reason that theory is wrong is that in Texas, the cases that have recognized a good cause exception are all in jurisdictions which permit that to occur. That is to say, common law jurisdictions. In fact, one of the cases they rely on, Briggs, in one respect can be viewed as a good cause case. We recognize that there is attorney-client privilege, but we're going to recognize a good cause exception here. The difference is if you are in a jurisdiction like Texas, which does not have a common law privilege, but rather one settled by rule, you must resolve that controversy within the context of that rule. And the two cases that I think illustrate that are on a chart which appears under tab 3 of the handout. That's a state of pouring, and ironically enough, Gump, which is a certified case from the California Court of Appeals, but one that's illustrative on this point. Those cases say that because there is a rule, the court is powerless to carve out a good cause exception. Those two cases permit the beneficiary the discovery only because they find that the joint client exception applies. That is the criteria that they use for that. We say that criteria cannot apply in states such as Texas and these other modern jurisdictions, which say that the fiduciary and the fiduciary alone. So that's my answer to good cause, is that we are not a good cause state.
Can you, in effect, apply a reverse application of the offensive use of a privilege as a shield and say, well, this is a defensive use to prevent a plaintiff from?
No, and that's an excellent point for this reason. And let me contrast this with offensive use. And Republic Insurance, one of the cases that I've just mentioned, is an offensive use case. Offensive use is a case involving waiver. It is waiver. Voluntary relinquishment of a known right. What we say in those cases is the client possesses the attorney-client privilege, but if the client sues offensively, the client is put to a choice. Stand on the privilege and drop the lawsuit, or maintain the lawsuit and waive the privilege. We do not apply that in the defensive situation. Why? Because when you're dealing with a defendant, as we're dealing with in this case, there cannot be any voluntary relinquishment of that right. And this is the principle that's been recognized, that when you're dragged into court, you cannot be put to the point of waiving that privilege. And so in this case, once we recognize that the privilege attaches, It's improper to do the reverse and go to the defensive because of the fact that does not accord with the type of principles that we recognize for offensive use.
No, but that response still doesn't do away with the good cause exception. And so your argument goes back.
Yes, it still goes back, correct.
We have a rule and we should apply it as written without establishing any exception.
That is correct. Right. Right. And what I would say here is this court wears two hats, in effect. One is the opinion writing and decision-making half. The other is the rulemaking half. And the only way to get to a fiduciary exception. What's that?
You're telling us we ought to follow our own rule.
That's
shorthand.
A shorthand way of putting that. And that if there is a fiduciary exception to be created, it should be done by many of that rule. Now, having said that, it shouldn't be done. The public policy reasons for not doing that are compelling. But within the framework, that's the answer. Now, the third point is this. Even were this court to disagree with everything I've just said and say that let's go ahead and follow the cases that they cite, the principal ones being Riggs and Cummings, the cases that say that the real client is the beneficiary, which we say is not the law in Texas. Let's say that you were to be persuaded to go that direction. In this case, the beneficiary who is suing is not suing as the beneficiary in the first instance. It is a suit in the individual capacity, and only alternatively as a beneficiary. Now, why is this significant? Because there is no jurisdiction in the country that has ever held that in this context that the individual can say that the fiduciary attorney is my attorney, and for that reason I get access to the documents. And further than that, in this case, there are three beneficiaries. Two beneficiaries are antagonistic, or the one beneficiary is pursuing relief, which is antagonistic to another. And the case I want to cite to the court is Barnett Banks, which is cited in our which is the one case that deals with this situation.
With regards to this issue, before you proceed, you stated the two sisters who have chosen not to sue their father,
yes,
and join the other sister who's saying, Dad, you're a crook because you're engaging in self-dealing.
Right.
How are their interests antagonistic? They're silent.
For this reason. The sum of the relief that is being sought in this case seeks to, well, two reasons. One, to the extent that suit is sought in an individual capacity as opposed to the benefit of the estate from which the money flows, that is money that does not go into the pockets of the two sisters. Second, some of the relief that is sought here is seeking to set aside transactions which have occurred over the past 15 years. And if that is accomplished, the effect will be, and this is the position that they believe. I mean, I'm just passing on. We haven't tried this case. This is the position Molly and Mindy, who are the two sisters, believe that an effect of that would be a disgorgement of funds that have come to them through the trust. And to that extent, there is this antagonism. Now, having said
that, what about the argument that the information they seek is not advice and counsel, but they're seeking just factual information?
Well, that's wrong. That's the answer to that. The answer to that is that they may be seeking facts and advice, but they are also seeking confidential communications. And if you look at the court's order, it is unlimited. It is unlimited. We've disputed back and forth, you know, specific questions that have been asked, but the point that is I want to get across is this is a situation where they are seeking to take the deposition of the lead counsel for this fiduciary for confidential communications going back 15 years. The court's order is unlimited in terms of what questions can be asked. In other words, what the court's order says is you, the fiduciary, cannot claim the privilege. What that means, of course, is in any subsequent deposition, it need not be limited to the questions that are set forth in the brief. Anything is fair game. Once you say that the attorney-client privilege does not apply, which is what the court's order says, anything is fair game. So that's the real answer. Let's not quibble too much about questions that have been asked, and we've been quibbling. Recognize the order for what it is, and that is a blanket, open the door, you can inquire about confidential, and that is what makes it. Now, I prepared some charts, and I'll just quickly flip through them. The theme here, the first tab is 503A, which under, the theme is relatively straightforward. Under 503A, the first thing that you ask is who is the client. Once that determination is made, then under 503B, the general rule of privilege applies. That party is entitled to the confidentiality. Under 503C, who may claim the privilege? The fiduciary, or the client, or the attorney. And finally, under 503D, unless one of the exceptions apply. And our point is that under Thompson versus Vincent Elkins, which we believe, even though it is not a Supreme Court case, should be followed by this court, consistent with the modern jurisdictions, that threshold question has been answered and is dispositive.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Donovan Campbell will present arguments for respondents.
May it please the court, I would first like to point out that I speak on behalf of not just Melissa Chenault, one of the three daughters of Mr. Huey, but also on behalf of two other trust beneficiaries who are minors, 14-year-old Sarah, who is the daughter of Melissa, and 2-year-old Maddie, who is the natural daughter of Molly and Huey, but who is being cared for and is in the process of being adopted by Melissa. She has had an ad litem appointed for her by Justice Chazo, Mr. Jack Kennebrew. He has reviewed all the facts and the law and is in our camp and is not in the Huey camp. So I want it to be perfectly clear that I'm speaking for all three of those plaintiffs. They are all plaintiffs.
Well, let me see what the relationship is here. Besides the daughter who's claiming that her father's a crook, what is the relationship of the other two people you represent
to the father? The other two are plaintiffs in the suit. One is the 14-year-old daughter of Melissa.
And she would be a granddaughter?
Would be Huey's granddaughter, Mr. Huey's granddaughter. And the other would also be Mr. Huey's granddaughter, the legitimate granddaughter, Maddie, who is the natural daughter of Molly and Huey. Okay, we believe, ladies and gentlemen, that the linchpin of this case is not the who is the client question at all, which deals only with that issue in the context of privity, standing, malpractice cause of action, not in an attorney-client privilege standpoint. But the linchpin of this case is the fiduciary duty of full disclosure that a trustee and an executor owe to its beneficiaries. The other side has not contested this. There is a general duty under many Supreme Court cases in this state, a general duty of full disclosure by all fiduciaries to their beneficiaries. Bogart says that, the restatement, Second Trust says that, Scott says that, and four of your cases, Supreme Court cases from the state of Texas, Montgomery, Texas Bank and Trust, Johnson, and Willis, all have said that from 1938 until the present time. The common law also says that. We've cited the common law cases in our brief from England. We would also direct the court's attention to Texas Probate Code Section 32 and Trust Code Section 111.005, which adopts the common law of England in specific trust and executive situations such as we have here.
So I suppose there's no question that you could ask Mr. Huey all these questions.
Well, no, that's not true, Your Honor. The court, Mr. Huey's attorneys have taken the position that we cannot ask him these questions either because they raise the attorney-client privilege. As to those questions concerning facts and transactions that Mr. Huey and Mr. Ringer were involved in trust and administration matters for the past 15 years.
Well, I understand you can't ask Mr. Huey what he told Mr. Ringer, but you could ask Mr. Huey questions about what happened in the study.
To some extent we could. He doesn't know much about what happened in this case. For example, he doesn't know who specifically drafted all the documents that we claim were self-dealing and backdated deeds. Mr. Ringer, we think, knows that because he drafted it. There are many questions that we could not get answers to from Mr. Huey that we could get answers to from Mr. Ringer.
Hamill, beneficiaries, I mean, they have beneficial interest in the estate, but aren't they subject to the rule, how the state set up the rules on distribution and that's, I mean, beneficiaries can't control the decision-making with respect to the estate, can they?
Yes and no. In general, they can't control that decision-making.
So if they can't control that decision-making, then is it not inconsistent with the, would it be consistent with the notion that they can't control how the estate operates, to then say that the person who is responsible for controlling how the state operates can't have an attorney-client privilege with the lawyer. I mean, it seems to me that more often than not, beneficiaries, I mean, the reason you have an estate is so there's somebody who manages that, which could or could not be to what the beneficiary thinks is their own best interest. It doesn't make sense to then say that the beneficiary can, at any time, just walk in and say, now I want to know what the lawyer to the person who's charged with responsibility running this estate is telling him or her.
The answer is yes, and the reason is the person that is charged with the control and management of the estate is also charged with the duty of full disclosure to his beneficiaries. With respect to the whole entire rest of the world, that fiduciary can claim the attorney-client privilege. With respect to his particular beneficiaries, he cannot claim the attorney-client privilege to the exclusion of those beneficiaries unless he meets the three prerequisites set out.
Full disclosure, meaning that the fiduciary is required to disclose the fiduciary conversations with the fiduciary's lawyer.
Unless those conversations deal solely with his own defense that he has paid for out of his pocket and relate solely to matters of his defense and not to trust in the state administration.
Although you recognize that a beneficiary could be, a beneficiary's interest, perceived interest could be inconsistent with the trust that was set up for the beneficiary.
Well, a beneficiary's true interest could not be inconsistent. His perceived interest might be.
Do you read this as a joint, as part of the joint client exception to the attorney-client privilege, or is it an exception that merely exists in the common law?
Neither, Your Honor. Our primary position in this case is that the duty of full disclosure exists separate and apart, both historically and legally, from the attorney-client privilege rule in Texas.
But it does impact the attorney-client privilege.
It does impact the attorney-client privilege, absolutely. So we don't have to fit into an exception within the language of 503 because the duty of full disclosure is up here above the duty, excuse me, the rule concerning the attorney-client privilege. The duty of full disclosure controls or subsumes the rule, the evidentiary rule on attorney-client privilege.
Why is it? Why is the attorney-client privilege an exception to that rule? It seems like the thing we have to decide is, does one trump the other, or is one an exception?
Well, we suggest that that's how you should decide it. You should decide it that the full disclosure rule or duty of fiduciary trumps the attorney-client privilege. That's not necessary. I'll explain under the language of Rule 503 why that's not necessary, but we suggest that is the proper rule. And the reason for that is both historical, common law, and as a matter of current case law interpretations from other states.
Is there any other doctrine that trumps the attorney-client privilege? Now, all the other ones I can think of seem to be listed in this rule.
No, that's not correct, Your Honor. If there are, the courts of this state have held that the attorney-client privilege does not apply where the right to information exists separate and independent from the discovery and the evidence rules. We cited the Burton v. Carvey case, situation where condominium owners were trying to get information from the condominium association and its lawyer. The specific statute, condominium statute in this state, says that they have a right to inspect all the books and records of the association. They first tried to enforce that right without a lawsuit, then they had to enforce it through a lawsuit. And the court said, Houston First District, 1988, the attorney-client privilege does not apply where the party seeking the information has a right to it independent of any rule of discovery in litigation. That's exactly the case here. We have a right to this information, whether it's an attorney's opinions or not, independent from any rule of discovery or any rule of evidence. And so that right, in essence, does trump any rule of discovery because it exists separate and apart from rules of discovery and rules of evidence.
Is this a question of first impression for Texas?
This is a question of first impression.
The right you just said you have. Is it?
Pardon me?
The right you have to this information.
No, that is not. That is not a question of first impression. The question of first impression is how far does that right extend in Texas in the face of an attorney-client privilege claim by the fiduciary against his own beneficiaries? That is a case of first impression in Texas with respect to Texas state courts, not with respect to federal courts in Texas. The Comegys case has already addressed that from the Eastern District of Texas in 1993.
It's not unusual for beneficiaries to be at odds.
Correct.
And it seems a little unfair to make the trustee try to wrangle through all of that and probably hire counsel to do it, and then either not confide in that counsel or pay out of his own pocket, when really all he's only there because he's trying to represent his state, or else run the risk that the people that are at odds with one another are going to get at odds with him.
Well, we feel exactly the opposite, Your Honor. Assume, for argument's sake, that there are beneficiaries at odds in this case, or in any fiduciary case. Because the courts of this state, including the Supreme Court, say that there is a duty of impartiality on the beneficiary, on the fiduciary, as to how he treats all the beneficiaries, must be impartial. Because of that duty and the duty of full disclosure, in that situation, the fiduciary's duty to tell all is even more important. He should reveal what his lawyer tells him in the context of his advice as to how to administer the trust among competing claims of beneficiaries. He should do that in the full light of day. He shouldn't hide it in smoke-filled back rooms.
His decisions will always be second-guessed.
No, sir, I don't think so.
Well, if there's a disagreement among the beneficiaries of how he ought to do his duties, his decisions will always be second-guessed by one of the beneficiaries who is upset at the decisions that are being made by the fiduciaries.
My experience in this practice, Your Honor, is that it is rarely second-guessed.
Where's second-guessed here?
It is definitely second-guessed here. That's correct. And the reason I submit it is second-guessed here is, as Judge DeShazo has already ruled in the summary judgment motion, Mr. Hewitt has been found guilty of self-dealing already. He is a self-dealer, according to the trial court. Therefore,
I thought the trial of merits has not been had.
But the trial, summary judgment has been had, and Judge DeShazo has ruled he is guilty of self-dealing in at least one transaction. So all the parties are on notice that he is a self-dealer as a matter of law.
What's the significance of knowing what he was advised to do and what he actually did? As you say, he treated the beneficiaries unfairly. What would be the significance of knowing whether he was advised to do that?
One example of the significance of that would be if Mr. Ringer were allowed to answer the questions, and we said, Mr. Ringer, did you advise Mr. Huey when he entered into transaction X that that was an illegal act of self-dealing? If Mr. Ringer says yes, if he has to answer that question, then we have proved knowing self-dealing, knowing violation on the part of the fiduciary, and we get punitive damages, for example. That would be one example of how it could be quite relevant. On the other hand, if he got advice from his lawyer that said, this is not an act of self-dealing, it's okay, and Mr. Huey could claim that he acted on advice of counsel, and he shouldn't be held liable for that. So it's not just an abstract.
Did he make that claim?
Not that I'm aware of, because then that would be an offensive use of the privilege.
How much money is involved here? You know, we've got high-priced lawyers here making claims and counterclaims. We've got beneficiaries, each with their own counsel, and talk about punitive damages. Is there any danger that the corpus of the trust will be taken off by lawyers' fees?
Not in this context, and not from our side, for sure, Your Honor.
The well's pretty deep.
According to the defendant's own records, the three trusts, primary trusts at issue here, total at least $36 million in wealth.
Deep pockets.
Fairly deep. Now, what I'd like to turn to next is to, in essence, debunk this who is the client question. That is not the issue here. The issue is the duty of full disclosure on the part of the trustee. Now, the who is the client cases that the defendant cites, B&E, are all in the context of who is the client for purposes of determining standing privity in an attorney malpractice case. They do not address the issue of who is the client in the attorney-client privilege relationship context at all. Our cases do. Riggs discusses that. Comegys discusses that. They both contain language that says, in this case, we are looking at the issue of the attorney-client relationship from the standpoint of the attorney-client privilege relationship as distinguished from the attorney-client relationship for purposes of standing privity and a malpractice cause of action. That's why B&E is totally inapposite. It does not control this case. It is not the law in Texas. There is no law decided in Texas except by adoption of the common law as to how do you define the attorney-client relationship for purposes of the privilege relationship. Now, we submit that that is defined according to the common law, all the noted commentaries in the country, and all the cases from the six other states that have addressed this issue that have held in our favor. We submit that if you examine those cases, they all answer the question that in the context of the attorney-client privilege relationship, the privilege is controlled or can be controlled, is controlled by the duty of full disclosure that is on the trustee. In the context of the malpractice cause of action, privity, standing to sue an attorney directly, those cases can say what they want to about who is the client. They don't pertain to the question of who is the client, what is the attorney-client relationship in the context of a fiduciary relationship.
But if there is a possibility of lawsuit against the lawyer for malpractice, how can you administer an attorney-client privilege rule that's one way in one context and another way in the other?
Well, I haven't actually thought about that. Let me address that by telling you what the ABA Special Committee on this precise issue, returning client privilege in the fiduciary context, said, and we've submitted this in a letter to you. It said on pages 849 through 851 that the way we interpret the rules of evidence, and they rely on the rules of evidence, we, the ABA Special Committee, decide that the true client is the fiduciary, even though it's not a malpractice privy type issue. They said the true client is a fiduciary. Nevertheless, because of the duty of full disclosure that is upon the fiduciary, the lawyer hired by the fiduciary cannot refuse to give or to disclose his advice to the fiduciary in trust and administration matters from the beneficiary.
So if you're going to, the beneficiary says, lawyer, tell us what you know because we're suing you for malpractice, he can say no. But then if the beneficiary says, okay then, tell us what you know because you were the trustee's lawyer, then he has to tell them what he knows, and then they can sue him for malpractice.
Well, let's take the first case. If your question is, if the trust beneficiaries are suing the trustee's lawyer for malpractice, well, and they say, we want to breach the privilege, then my answer would be they could breach the privilege for purposes of obtaining trust administration advice that he gave to the fiduciary. They could not breach the privilege for purposes of trying to get at any advice that the lawyer gave the fiduciary concerning the fiduciary's own defense of his actions in administering the trust.
Even if the estate paid for it?
Well, that's a more difficult question. I would say, no, not if the estate paid for it. And he's waived it. And there is an issue of waiver here. And that issue of waiver is when Mr. Dewey or any fiduciary accepts his fiduciary appointment, he makes a decision. He should know the rules. He should know the duty of full disclosure. He should know the duty of impartiality. He can decline to accept his position as a trustee or administrator or executor, or he can decide to accept it and later resign. He has that right. But if he accepts the position, then he has waived his attorney-client privilege with respect to the beneficiaries only. And he makes that election when he steps into that office because he knows or should know all of his fiduciary duties.
Does that theory fulfill the part of the test of waiver, an intentional relinquishment of the known right?
I think it does.
So because I'm saying that trustee is supposed to know all about attorney-client privilege, and so forth.
I'm saying the trustee should know the duties of full disclosure and the duties of impartiality that he owes to his beneficiary. Yes, absolutely. Particularly when he's advised by counsel throughout the 15-year period of the estate and the trust. Yes. So it does meet all the requirements for a waiver. Although we don't need that. Again, principal point I'm trying to make is, in this case, the right to the attorney-client information concerning trust and estate administration exists separate and apart from any rules of discovery or any rules of evidence. That is because of the duty of full disclosure that's imposed on a fiduciary. That duty requires the fiduciary to disclose to his beneficiaries and his beneficiaries only all the legal advice that he has gotten from his attorney concerning trust and estate administration matters, not concerning defense of himself personally from a charge of violation of fiduciary duty, for example, after a true question has arisen, when he pays for it himself, and when that relates solely to his defense in that claim.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May I please report?
Would you address the comment made by Mr. Campbell that Mr. Nall has already proven or obtained a judgment or finding a fact in some fashion that her dad's a crook?
Yes. Interlocutory ruling. We don't agree with it. Will be contested. If incorporated into final judgment, would be appealed. Most importantly, irrelevant to the question for this court, which is how do we deal with issues of attorney-client privilege? I mean, this is all going to end up being litigated. We've got two of the beneficiaries saying everything that Dad's done is fine. One says not. The court's going to decide that. But that, how that ultimately turns out, either interlocutorily or ultimately, should not affect the predicate question of attorney-client privilege. So that's how I address that. Now, I wanted to make 4 points on the rebuttal. First, addressing the linchpin argument they make. Second, addressing some of the policy concerns raised by Justice Enoch. Third, addressing Burton v. Carvey. Fourth, finally, the ABA article. And I'm sure I will run out of time by then. So on that one, I will probably submit a post-submission brief addressing footnote 47, which cites these cases. Turning to the linchpin argument, their position is that the issue is not who is the client. And I would just ask you to turn to tab 3 of the handout. That we created, which deals with these cases from other jurisdictions, all of which consider the threshold question to be, who is the client? And the one we quote at the top, the central question is whether the trustee or the beneficiary is properly viewed as the client for purposes of the privilege. Now, there's been some suggestion that, well, what we ought to do is come up with a kind of a split-your-britches approach, which is we'll examine privilege for legal malpractice one way, who is the client? If one way, who is the client? Another way for something else. No jurisdiction has ever done that. No jurisdiction has ever done that in this country. No jurisdiction has concluded that for one purpose, the client is the fiduciary, but for another, it is the beneficiaries. And it would be troubling to do that for obvious reasons. The most important one being the public policy implications of that. And I want to turn to that now. The question of who is the client in Texas has independent legal significance in multiple different contexts. Legal malpractice, strict privity rule. Question, who is the client? Texas Rule of Civil Evidence, 503A, who is the client by definition? Our rules of disciplinary rules of professional conduct are predicated on the question of who is the client. The burdens that are placed on the attorney under the disciplinary rules, and I'll cite specifically 1.06, the conflict of interest rules say, if you are the client, if all these people are the client, if these are the joint clients, then you, at the outset, have to make an inquiry of, do I have a conflict of interest? Can I represent these people? If I can represent these people, I need to get informed consent from everyone. If I have a minor, we bring in an attorney ad litem to make that inquiry. That is the inevitable conclusion that you would draw from doing that. Now, from the standpoint of the attorney, as the court has recognized, this is a family feud. And in these family feuds, this is where you really need the protection of the privilege. You cannot say, I would submit, to the fiduciary sitting across from you, now, we're having our first meeting, we're going to be administrating this estate together, and I know that you may have various feelings, maybe ones that you've discussed with your deceased wife about each of the daughters and how this should be handled. But you need to understand that anything you say to me is discoverable. Now evaluate that under Westby Salido. Legate. What are you saying? The foundation of the attorney-client relationship is the attorney-client privilege. That's like saying to someone, well, okay, we'll give you the house, but you don't get the roof. You don't get the protection. That is an unworkable situation if you say that. Now, they say that Texas
there, there were three separate trusts here, the way this will was set up.
Right.
But you're saying there were inevitably conflicts, that the trustee had inevitable conflicts among the management of those three trusts?
Yes, I'd say that. And if you look at under tab two, the cases from the monitor jurisdictions, they recognize that.
Go ahead.
Yes, and I'll give an example that would illustrate the problem.
I'll listen.
Okay. Mama, 6 months before she dies, says, okay, I will loan you $100,000 to buy a house. Happens all the time. That mama says, when I die, if you've not paid it back, that will come out of your share. Mama dies. Fiduciary says, attorney for fiduciary, fiduciary says, look, I've got to get the money back from so-and-so, but no. That beneficiary says, it wasn't in writing. Statute of frauds. It was a gift. And the attorney is in the position of saying, well, this is an interesting situation because I represent you. Under their view, under Riggs, I represent you. That cannot be. And the modern jurisdictions have considered that, have said because of that, public policy dictates that the attorney-client privilege be established solely between the attorney and the fiduciary.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second clause, and both of the clauses we've heard this morning will be submitted to the court on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
Audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.